So for those of you who don't know where we ended to, we got to paragraph 32. In other words, the last one was paragraph 31.
Sorry,
31 was the last paragraph last week, so we begin again on paragraph 32. I read paragraph 31 again because that's just a nice one. And so we can start now. Here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So here we go. This is the Potapada Sutta, and it's a deep sutta about, first of all, it has some very good descriptions. Oh, I've got some more here. Very good descriptions of the jhana states and also some of the other questions which a couple of people, especially Potapada, were asking of the Buddha. And they got some very, very deep answers. And as somebody mentioned to me, they liked paragraph 31, because even in the time of the Buddha, with a great teacher like the Buddha, still people said things like this. Paragraph 31. Then the wanderers, as soon as the Lord had left, reproached, sneered, and jeered at Potapada from all sides, saying, whatever the ascetic Gotama, that's the Buddha, says, Potapada agrees with him. So it is, Lord. So it is, welfarer. We don't understand a word of the ascetic Gotama's whole discourse. Is the world eternal or not? Is it finite or finite? Is the soul the same as a body or different? Does the Tathagata exist after death or not, or both or neither? And Potapada replied, I don't understand either about whether the world is eternal or not, etc. But the ascetic Gotama teaches a true and real way of practice, which is consonant with Dhamma and grounded in Dhamma. And why should not a man like me express approval of such a true and real practice so well taught by the ascetic Gotama? And that's actually where we finished last time. It's halfway through the sutta. And so now we come to paragraph 32. Now that particular paragraph, I read it out again because it is the case that sometimes when we first hear these things, we don't fully understand it. But there are plenty of things which a Buddha does teach which are so well grounded, so easy to accept. It's not airy-fairy stuff which sounds good, but when you examine it, doesn't really have any meaning. It is very, very clear, practical, down to earth, but just because it's practical, it does not mean it's not profound. Again, I've thought many times, and hopefully you get this into your consciousness as well, that just because you don't understand it does not mean it's profound. Because sometimes you think, did you understand that? No, but it was very deep. So please don't think like that. So what he's saying, yes, it was very deep, you know, and actually the important part of it I did understand. So anyway, 2 or 3 days later, Chitta, the son of the elephant trainer, went with Potapada to see the Buddha. So the Buddha had gone to see them, and now these two went themselves to see the Buddha. And Chitta prostrated himself before the Lord and sat down at one side. Potapada exchanged courtesies with the Lord, sat down to one side and told him what had happened. So the very fact that Chitta prostrated, bowed to the Buddha, meant that he was a disciple. And that Potapada, even though he was very impressed with the Buddha, he just exchanged courteous greetings. So even in the time of the Buddha, people wouldn't always bow to the Buddha. They'd only bow to the Buddha if they had respect for him. So even when people come here, you don't always need to bow to the monks. You know, some people do, some people don't. Just as in the time of the Buddha. So, you know, you pay respects to Venerable Nirodha, you know, because you respect her, but you don't have to. Instead, you can just exchange courteous greetings with Venerable Naroda. And so, the other thing is that they also refer to the Buddha as Lord. So if ever you come across a person who goes in the middle of Hay Street Mall or somewhere saying, "Praise the Lord, praise the Lord," you can always join in as well. "Yes, praise the Lord, Buddha." And if any of you who ever been to Bodhidharma Monastery, Casey Wong would always do that. You know, Casey always goes, praise the Lord, when he comes to Bodhidharma Monastery. So, Potapada exchanged courtesies with the Lord, sat down to one side and told him what had happened, which was paragraph 31 here, after the Buddha left, or the wanderers were basically saying that they didn't understand what he had said. And the Buddha replied, "Potapada, all those wanderers, they're blind and sightless. You alone among them are sighted. Some things I have taught and pointed out, Potapada, as being certain." And basically, you can actually understand them. "Others as being uncertain. Which are the things I pointed out as uncertain? The world is eternal, not eternal, both, etc. The Tathagata exist after death or not exist after death. Why? Because they're not conducive to Nibbana. That is why I have declared them as uncertain." So he's called some of those things as speculations, as things which don't have a real answer because the question is not formulated properly. Now, last fortnight, I did actually mention that the answer to, you know, does the Buddha exist after death or not exist after death? And many people think, well, you know, we all know that the Buddha, Parinibbana, disappears. But in order to understand the real, a deeper understanding of that question, what happens to a Buddha or to an arahat, an enlightened being, after they die, I'm going to read out another little sutta, which is a very famous one, which is from the Kanda Sangyutta in the Sangyutta Nikaya. It's called the Yamaka Sangyutta. And it takes a little bit of time, but I think it's really worthwhile including this one, because it really gets to the heart of how a Buddhist understands, you know, what happens when a person who's enlightened passes away, and why the Buddha never answered these questions, because they're not put in the correct way. So here we go. The Yamaka Sutta from the Kanda Sangyutta is number 85. "On one occasion, the Venerable Sariputta was dwelling at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park. Now, on that occasion, the following wrong view had arisen in a monk named Yamaka. Namely, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, a monk whose taints are destroyed, in other words, an arahat, is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death. A number of monks heard that such a wrong view had arisen in the monk Yamaka. Then they approached the Venerable Yamaka and exchanged greetings with him, after which they sat down to one side and said to him, 'Is it true, friend Yamaka, that such a wrong view has arisen in you? Namely, as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Buddha, a person whose taints are destroyed, an arahat, is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body and does not exist after death?' 'Exactly so, friends.' 'Friend Yamaka, don't speak that. You do not represent the Buddha. It is not good to misrepresent the Buddha. The Blessed One would not speak thus.' Yet although he was admonished by the monks in this way, the Venerable Yamaka still obstinately grasped that wrong view, adhered to it, and declared it. Since those monks were not able to detach the Venerable Yamaka from that wrong view, they rose from their seats and they went to Venerable Sariputta, and they asked Venerable Sariputta, 'It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would approach the Bhikkhu Yamaka out of compassion for him.' Then the Venerable Sariputta consented by silence." In the time of the Buddha, the monks and the nuns would usually show consent by just remaining silent. But please don't use that trick these days with the monks and nuns here. A lot of times, if it's silent, it's because I don't understand the heck what you're trying to ask. It's not to be It's known as consent. So here in the Western, I have to say yes. Venerable Nirodha has to say, yes, I will go to your house for that ceremony. Just because she's silent does not mean that it means yes. So if I don't answer your email, don't consider it consent by silence. So anyway, this particular case, Venerable Sariputta's silence meant, yes, you will go. So that evening, the Venerable Sariputta emerged from seclusion. He approached the Venerable Yamaka and exchanged greetings with him, after which he sat down to one side and said to him, is it true, friend Yamaka? It's just the way that monks would talk to each other, just they call him friend, that such a wrong view has arisen in you. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Buddha, an arahat is annihilated and perishes at the breakup of the body and does not exist after death. Exactly so, friend, said Yamaka. So here comes Sariputta's argument. What do you think, friend Yamaka, is form, which includes the body, other people's bodies, is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, friend. And is what is impermanent, what is impermanent, is that suffering or is that happiness? Is suffering. Yeah. If what is suffering and impermanent, is that appropriate to say this is me, this is mine, this is the self? No. And it's the same with the other four khandhas. This thing we call feeling, which is the that effective quality of all sensory experience which gives a positive flavor to the experience or a negative flavor, beauty and ugliness, pain and happiness, pain and pleasure, sorry. So, you know, this is what we call Vedana, the second of the five khandhas. Do you regard feeling as permanent or impermanent? Impermanent. Do you regard it, what is impermanent, as happiness or suffering? You say it's suffering. And the reason why it's suffering is because it's never consistent. You can never rely upon it. Sometimes it's nice, sometimes it's not so nice. Because of its impermanence, it's not really good enough. So what is impermanent and suffering? Is that fit to regard as this is me, this is mine, not this is a self? No. And it's the same with perception. Again, this part of the cognitive faculty which perceives things as man or woman, perceives things as blue, yellow or white, perceives, you know, the trees, as cars, whatever. This is the way we interpret our sensory experience. Is that permanent or impermanent? It's impermanent. Is what is impermanent? Is it happiness or suffering? It is suffering. Is what is suffering? Is that fit and impermanent? Is that fit to regard as this is me, this is mine, this is the self? No. The reason why you can't say it's mine, if it was yours, you'd be able to control it. Just like, you know, it's your house, your car, you can actually do what you want with it. But, you know, with some of these feelings, it'd be wonderful to be able to control these things. Oh, I'm not going to get sick, I'm not going to hurt, I'm always going to be healthy. You can't control these things. That's why they're suffering, which means that this is not me, not mine, it can't be yourself. And the same with the volitional formations, which includes your will, your thoughts. Are they? Do they belong to you? Are they permanent, impermanent? They're impermanent, they come and go. Is what is impermanent, is that suffering or happiness? It's suffering. And is what is impermanent and suffering, is that fit to be regarded as me, mine and the self? No, they're not. And lastly, consciousnesses, the six consciousnesses. I keep liking to call them consciousnesses instead of consciousness, because that makes a very strong point. There are six totally different types of consciousness, one going from one to the other to the other. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching and knowing. Totally different. So they keep changing. As they permanent or impermanent, they're always impermanent. You can actually see them flip from one of the six to the other. And is what is impermanent, is that happiness and suffering? It is suffering. Is what is impermanent and suffering, is that fit to be regarded as me, mine and self? No. So, you say these five khandhas, they're not a self. Here it's actually saying, do you regard what do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard form as the Buddha, you know, his body? No, friend. Do you regard his feeling as what the Buddha is? No. Do you regard perception as the Buddha? No. Do you regard the will as the Buddha? No. Do you regard consciousnesses as the Buddha? No, friend. What do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard the Buddha somehow contained in the body, just like a little imp or something living somewhere in the body? No, friend. Do you regard the Tathagata as apart from the body? No, friend. You know, if the body was not there, where's the Buddha? Do you regard the Tathagata as contained within feeling? No, as somehow separate from the feeling. No. Do you regard it as inside perception or apart from perception? As in will or somehow apart from will? As in consciousness or somehow apart from consciousnesses? No, friend. What do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard these five khandhas, you know, the body, the feeling, perception, will, and consciousness, the body and the mind all taken together as the Buddha? No, friend. What do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard the Buddha as one who is outside of form, feeling, perception, will, and consciousness? No, friend. So all the possibilities there, you know, what actually is the Buddha? And using the five khandhas, you know, as a way of just pointing out, is the Buddha consciousness? That was answered first of all. Is it within consciousness? Is it apart from consciousness? All these things taken together? Is that the Buddha? Or is it apart from the Buddha? And every time, a wise person has to say no. And then Sariputta says, but friend, when the Buddha is not apprehended by you as real and actual here in this very life, when you can't point to the Buddha here now, is it fitting for you to declare, as I understand the Dharma taught by the Buddha, one who is an arahat is annihilated and perishes with the breakup of the body, it does not exist after death? What they're saying here, there's nothing you can actually see here as a Buddha right now. There's nothing you can see here as a Venerable Naroda right now. Venerable Naroda, are you your body? Are you your feelings? No, you don't actually say that. You don't. People say that, I'm happy, or I'm miserable. And actually, when you identify with that, I'm really miserable, then you really get depressed. When you say, it's just misery, nothing to do with me, none of my business, then you're totally apart from that, you don't get depressed. Now, are you your perceptions? Are you your will? Are you your consciousnesses? Which one is it, which is my real me? And now, am I apart from that? Sometimes outside of that? Am I inside of it? And you just can't put any being in there anywhere when you really examine it. So you can't actually see a Venerable Naroda now. So when Venerable Naroda becomes enlightened and disappears, how can you say you can't see her now? So how can you say that something has perished and disappeared? Now that is what the Buddha is saying. Yeah?
This is a giant head trip, unless you can...
Sorry.
Monday, that's just a giant head trip unless you can actually see the arising and passing away. It's a very fancy and reasonable intellectualization, but it doesn't help for someone who's riddled with anxiety to say that there's no real me here. Isn't it really a matter of actually, it's not until you can actually see the arising and passing away of those things in deep meditation.
Seeing the arising and passing away of those things is the first step. It's one of the possibilities there. But it's seeing these things for what they truly are. I mean, one of the points which I made, and I flipped over very quickly because it's not the main part of this sutta class, was that we don't call it consciousness, we call it consciousnesses. Six totally different types of consciousnesses. And we flip from one to the other. When we're seeing, we're not knowing. When we're knowing, we're not hearing. When we're feeling the body, we're not sort of smelling. Six totally different sensory experiences. Now, when you see things come and pass away like that, you can actually see that this is a very powerful truth. And one of the reasons why people get deceived into thinking this is a flow of one thing called consciousness is because whenever we see something, that is usually followed by knowing we've seen. As soon as we've felt a pain or a pleasure in our body, then we know we felt that pain. So it's this mental consciousness, one of the six types, always follows after one of the other types. Even that saying that one of the arguments for existence is, I know that I know. That is not accurate. You always know that you knew. And if we can only put in that temporal link, when you know you knew something. And then we find out that just this whole idea of a being, which is always there, stable, continuous, is the illusion. It is so similar to when I was a kid, used to go to the seaside, and this is way before the days of computers, and used to have this little machine called What the Butler Saw machine. You put a penny in the slot, and you flipped a lever, and these still, actually drawings or photographs, would go very, very quickly. And it would give the illusion of movement. So only because it went fast, you think there was a continuity of the characters on those still photographs. And that was slow enough to be able to notice that, yes, they were stills, but moving so fast, it gave the perception of movement. And now that is so similar to the flow of still moments of consciousness. One type of consciousness, one flowing after the other, so fast. That just even seeing movement, you should all know just the anatomy of sight. It's a chemical reaction. That chemical reaction takes a time to form an image on your retina. It's not a continuous flow, it's spat, bap, 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 bap of images which we perceive as movement. But there's no continuity there. It's so fast, that's what it feels like. And that's a problem with consciousness, which gives us the illusion of there's always something constant there. Me, the knower.
So are you suggesting then that this is where the role of faith comes in, when you've heard a teacher like you say that, and then you just keep plugging away at stillness to the point where you hopefully can
This actually comes to the paragraph 31. Potapada and his friends say, I don't understand a word of what you said, but, it sounds intriguing. So just because you haven't experienced it yet does not mean it's not worth saying. It's intriguing, and it's intriguing enough actually to give you something to look out for when you do have these very still and amazing moments of consciousness in deep meditation. That's why we put it in there. So it's not going to overcome the anxiety of some of your clients, but it's going to overcome your anxiety. The people who are really meditating and one day actually see, my goodness, it sounds good. It's not something which you can't understand. You can understand it, but you can't believe it because you haven't experienced it yet.
Thank you.
But you can understand it. So, well, the Buddha is actually saying here, the Tathagata, the Buddha, you've gone to talk to him. It's not apprehended. You can't pin it down. What actually is the Buddha? It's not the body, it's not the consciousness, it's not the knowing. What actually is it? And you can't pin it down. And most importantly, you can't actually say it's outside of the five khandhas. It says that specifically here. And unfortunately, there are many monks who keep on saying, oh no, this is the original mind which is outside of the five khandhas. This particular sutta here totally confounds that idea. It says there's nothing outside. So, is it fitting for you to declare that? And he says, no. And this is where Yamaka says, formerly, friend Sariputta, when I was ignorant, I did hold that wrong view. But now I have heard this Dharma teaching by the Venerable Sariputta, I understand, and I've abandoned that wrong view and made the breakthrough into Dhamma, which is the way they say in Buddhism, stream winning. He's seen it. There's no self there. So this was enough for this guy to understand. He understood that he thought there was a Buddha there, a self, a being. And through this analysis, think, Chucky, you're right. Remember, this is coming from one of the great teachers, Sariputta. So when Sariputta said this, people get stream winning. When Ajahn Brahm says it, sorry, not powerful enough. But it's still, it's fascinating. This is what made the breakthrough for him.
I said to myself, well, I guess if you put all those things together, that is the person.
Yeah.
Whatever the feeling, whatever it is, put all those together, yes, that's the person.
Yeah, but this is, again, you were we didn't get the microphone to you fast enough. You said when you were faced with this problem before, you said, no, each one of these individually is not the person, but together they're the person. You know, the sum of the parts, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. But as she says here, what do you think, friend Yamaka? Do you regard form, feeling, perception, volitional formations and consciousness taken together as a Buddha? No. So it's wrong. It's actually put that down. It's not. And this is a brilliant part of this. So, if friend Yamaka, they were to ask you, friend Yamaka, when a monk or a nun or a lay person is an arahat, what happens to them with the breakup of the body after death? Being asked that, how would you answer? So this was the Buddha just testing out to see if Yamaka really understood. And this is what Yamaka answered. If they were to ask me this, friend, I would answer thus. Friends, form, body is impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Feeling, perception, volitional formations, including thought and will, consciousnesses, they're impermanent. What is impermanent is suffering. What is suffering has ceased and passed away. Just that. Being asked such, friend, I would answer in such a way. Good, good. Sadhu, sadhu, friend Yamaka. So this is actually where the Sariputta said, yes. So this is actually how a person answers that question. Now, it's not does a Tathagata exist after death or not exist after death. This is a Buddha. Does a Buddha exist after death or not exist after death, or both exist and not exist after death, or neither exist nor not exist after death, if you can figure that one out. And he said, no, that's the wrong question. The answer is not a yes or a no to any of those questions. It's put in the wrong way. All you say is, there's just these five khandhas, there's body, there's feeling, perception, these mental formations, which catches everything else in the mental world, and consciousnesses. They were just impermanent, they were suffering. What is impermanent and suffering has passed away and ceased. That's all. Brilliant. Doesn't matter if you don't understand that, because even if you don't understand it, or maybe understand it intellectually, you may not have penetrated it, but at least you have the answer. Just like that time in my own journey when Ajahn Chah asked me that question, Bama Wangso, why? And I said, I don't know. And he laughed and he said, I'll tell you the answer anyway. The answer to the question, why? There is nothing. That was the answer. Do you understand, Bama Wangso? I said, yes, Master. He said, no, you don't. But nevertheless, it was worthwhile telling me. Because when you get these great sayings from, you know, powerful sayings, they actually stay with you. So this one actually stays with you. That, even though you don't understand it, it's worth telling you.
It's interesting because I've been periods of deep, long...
Very good.
In periods of deep and long meditation, I have different experiences come up. Well, my experience is that there's always a Brahma Vangso one-liner that just encapsulates the experience right in the deep place of meditation. It's like a signpost, go this way, or a signpost, go that way. And it's not something that I ever think about when I start to meditate.
Exactly. How many times have I told you, especially when you come on retreats, that I'm brainwashing you? Of course I have. Ajahn Chah brainwashed me. He put these sayings inside of you. And they disappear. You forget about them. You know, you should know this as a psychologists. They are stored there. And when they're needed, it's like a resonance happens. And they come up. And actually they tell you, you know, why? There's nothing. Oh, yeah, I get it now. It's just waiting there for the right time, like a seed in the Australian outback where it doesn't rain for so many years. And when it does rain, it just bursts forth into flower. Stay there for years, maybe decades, waiting for that first drop of rain to germinate it, and the flowers just bloom. And that's why we say things like this. You know, what happens after the end of an arahat's life? Just what were these five khandhas? They were impermanent, they were suffering. What is impermanent suffering has just passed away. That's all. There was nothing there to begin with. There's nothing there now. Da-da-da. And don't worry, because if you say, I don't understand this, remember paragraph 31. Well, I don't understand either about whether this... but it sounds good. So anyway... But, it's the end of paragraph 33, but what things have I pointed out as certain? This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to cessation of suffering. Why? Because they are conducive to the purpose, conducive to Dharma. They're the way to embark on the holy life. They lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to calm, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. That is why I've declared them as certain. So, you know, suffering. You know what suffering is? Yeah, how much suffering you've had so far in your life. So that's something which is solid, which is not some metaphysical ideal which you have to sort of struggle to comprehend. And obviously the cause of suffering, very simple, desire and craving. You know when you want something. You know, you don't get it. That's certainly a suffering. But even wanting it means you can't rest, you can't relax until you... It makes you work and strive to get what you want. And how many times in your life you get what you want and is this it? I still remember I did my marriage once. And you know, just to the marriage, the girl said, this is supposed to be the happiest day of my life after the marriage. And she said, is this it? The happiest day of my life? Is this it? Oh my God. Anyway. Well, the great question she asked. So some of the suffering, the craving, and then the end of craving, you know, is the third noble truth. It's letting go of craving. And every time I keep mentioning, the most peaceful and wonderful experience you've ever had in your life is when you've been content somewhere. It is sitting by some lake somewhere, watching the waves go in and out, being on some holiday somewhere, just sitting there, just having nothing to do, nowhere to go. You know, if you had a choice, you know, have another friend with you, say, no, just this is absolutely perfect. I wouldn't be anywhere else except just here right now with the people I'm with. Utter contentment. No desires. That gives you a taste of freedom. That is a taste of the third noble truth. Contentment, the absence of desires, totally at peace with where you are, with who you're with. A taste of freedom. That's why the most happiest experiences people ever have, the so-called spiritual epiphanies, the times when you're just at home, maybe not in a sort of particularly religious place, you just feel totally content and happy, where there's no desires. And of course the path is, you know, it's hard to do that all the time. We've got this Eightfold Path, how to let go of things. So that is actually why he taught those things. Those are something you can understand much better than what I said before about, you know, is the Tathagata, the Buddha, outside of the five khandhas or inside of the five khandhas or wherever, because this is something which you can work with. This is grounding the teachings. And this is where the Buddha now comes on page 166 to some of the ideas people have, which, you know, just are airy-fairy and they don't really... last when you actually question them deeply. Paragraph 34. Potapada, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who declare and believe that after death the self is entirely happy and free from disease. Can you give me one religion which suggests that? That after... Mormons, Christianity, anyone else? They all believe that. If you're a good person, you go to heaven, and then when you go to heaven, you are entirely happy and free from disease. It would be nice, wouldn't it? But what happened, that's one of the reasons why. I mean, one thing I like about the Catholic Church, at least it's consistent. Because, you know, in the Anglican Church, imagine you can actually get divorced, you can marry again. What happens if both of your wives go to heaven? You think that's good? Your internal happiness will be short. So that's why in Catholicism you can only get married once, only can have one wife, one husband. And there's good reason for that, because that makes things much more simple when you go to heaven. Please excuse me. So they believe that after death, the self is entirely happy and free from disease. And I approached them and asked if this was indeed what they declared and believed. And they replied, yes. And I said, do you friends living in the world here, do you know and see an entirely... Do you friends living in this world know and see it as an entirely happy place, in our world? And they replied, no, of course not. Have you ever experienced a single night or day or half a night or day that was entirely happy? Have you ever had a whole day been entirely happy? Mostly happy, but, you know, there's always some unhappiness, like having to go to the toilet or something goes wrong. So say, no. Do you know a path or practice whereby an entirely happy world might be brought about? And they replied, no. Have you heard the voices of these heavenly beings who have been reborn in an entirely happy world saying, the attainment of an entirely happy world has been well and rightly gained, and we, gentlemen, have been reborn in such a realm? And have you been told this by devas? And they replied, no. What do you think, Potapada? Such being the case, does not the talk of those ascetics and Brahmins turn out to be stupid? That's what they say down here, stupid. How do you know there's a heaven afterwards? You know, can you actually imagine how it can be made up? Have you been actually told some devas have come down to you, some gods, and said, yes, this is an entirely happy world? They wouldn't do that. That's, they're coming down here, they lose all their happiness. But whatever, they say no. And this is where the Buddha gets one of his great similes. It's just as if a young man were to say, I am going to seek out and love the most beautiful girl in the country. They may say to him, well, as to this most beautiful girl in the country, do you know which caste she belongs to? The Kshatriya, the Brahmins, the merchants, or the artisan class? He would say, no. Then they might say, well, do you know her name, her clan, whether she is tall or short or medium height, whether she is dark or light-complexioned or sallow-skinned, of what village or town or city she comes from? You would say, no. And they might say, well then, you don't know or see the one you seek for and desire? You would say, no. Does not the talk of that man turn out to be stupid? Certainly, Lord. He doesn't know who he's looking for. And so it is with those ascetics and Brahmins who declare and believe that after death the self is entirely happy and free from disease. Like seeking out the most beautiful place to live after you die, you don't even know where it exists or what it is. Or it's just as if a man were to build a staircase for a palace at a crossroad. A palace is like a mansion, like a big house. It's like, instead of a staircase, you can actually say your garden path of your house. Suppose a person were to build a garden path for a house. People might say to him, well, now, this path for your house that you are building, do you know whether the house will face east or west or north or south or will be high, low, or medium height? And you say, nope, we're just building the path first. And they might say, well, you don't know or see what kind of house you are building, where the front door will be, where the back door will be, and you're building the garden path first? No. Don't you think that man's talk would be turn out to be stupid? Of course. You've got to know where the door is before you put the path to it. Potapada. So this is actually saying that people who believe there's going to be an entirely happy realm after you die, that turns out to be an unsubstantiated myth. And remember, that's what most people look for. Happiness ever after. A world, a realm where you can live entirely happy without disease. It's the myth of Prince Charming and Cinderella, who once they meet at last can ride off into the sunset, happy ever after, in a realm with only happiness and no more disease. The myth of Walt Disney. It's amazing just how many people in religion think like that. You can actually, as long as you keep your five precepts, give enough donations that when you die, you live happily ever after, just like Prince Charming and Cinderella. The myth continues in the next realm. The Buddha is really tough. He said, no, that is like searching for the most beautiful girl in the country. You don't know where she is. So, instead of that, we're talking about cessation. Not an entirely happy realm, when the realms all vanish. So, paragraph 39. We go into another idea of this self. Now, not the self going to a nice, happy realm to live happily ever after, but actually starting to talk about what this idea of a self actually is. So 39, Potapada, there are three kinds of acquired self. It's a very beautiful word. It's not an existing self. It's actually how you make up a self. Not one which is pre-existing, one which you fabricate. And fabricating is a nice word. Because fabricating, you know, it's not real. It's just you make it up, and it appears to be real to you. So there's three kinds of what I call fabricated self. The gross fabricated self, the mind-made fabricated self, and the formless fabricated self. What is the gross fabricated self? It has form, you know, body. It is composed of the four great elements, basically stuff, nourished by food. What is a mind-made fabricated self? It has form, complete with all its parts, not defective of any sense organ. This is like the mind-made body. Some people call it the astral body, the thing which happens when you have a near-death experience, what you see if you see a ghost. And just for your interest, to make this talk a little bit more spicy, not yesterday, but 8 days ago, I was performing a funeral service for somebody. It was a burial, they were Chinese. And it was a long way from the gate at Karakata to the plot for the Chinese people. So it was a walk of, you know, maybe almost a kilometre. And walking, you know, in front of the hearse with the funeral director, who was from Bower and O'Days, just wanting something to pass the time, I just started chatting to her. And asked how long she'd been in her job. She said she'd worked for that company for 16 years. 16 years, I said. Have you any ghost stories? And she said, yes, many. Many times in the funeral homes, she's seen people standing in her office who should be in the box. What was the best one you've had? I asked her. And she said, once she said, oh, she had to go back a little bit. The hearse, they have a person employed especially to clean the hearse up after every funeral to make it ready for the next funeral. Because if that's your loved one, you don't want to put that casket in a dirty car. So it is actually cleaned up before every new coffin goes in. I got a guy who does that. And so the guy had cleaned up the hearse and locked it up, waiting for the next funeral. And then, for no discernible reason, inexplicably, inside, it misted up. And all the glass windows of the hearse had this condensation appear on the inside. And then after the condensation appeared, handprints appeared on the inside, all on the windows, of which there were many on a hearse, covered with handprints. Something inside was trying to get out. Great ghost story. And that's what you told me, that one. Now, that's what we call like the mind-made body in Buddhism, like the ghost body. Perfect in all its parts. In other words, as it was buried, that's how it appears. Many times it's happened. People who have died, whatever you dress them in the coffin, if they are a ghost, that's how they appear to people. So that's why it is a good idea to put someone in a nice suit or a nice dress. Because when they go out, that's what they'll be wearing when they go and haunt somebody. It's actually true. Okay, I better not go on, because I've gone for hours on these stories. But anyway, that is the idea of the mind-made body. Perfect in its, all its parts. It looks just as if, you know, when it was dead.
Does it always occur after death, or do you have some time to the real body hanging around?
Sometimes just before death, the person's in and out. And it's just like the astral travelling, the near-death experiences. You know, people actually feel themselves floating out of the body, and they experience themselves. You know, if you're Chris Perry, you'd experience yourself with glasses on. Okay, you know, even though you don't need glasses, but that's, you know, if you've been wearing your glasses when you're dead, that's what you'll feel you're wearing. If you're wearing that shirt and shorts, you feel like you're wearing shorts. No shoes on, you feel like you've got no shoes on. This is what it says: perfect in all its parts, the same hairstyle, the same 5 o'clock shadow if you haven't shaved. That's how you will appear. That's why they say here, this mind-made body, or the mind-made acquired self, what I call it, fabricated self, is it has form complete with all its parts, not defective in any sense organ. In other words, you can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, know. That's why the mind-made self, when people have those near-death experiences, they think they can see, they can feel, they can hear. And it turns out they are actually hearing real speech. It's just usually attachment or just unfinished business, I like to say. You know, the unfinished business. You know that story, that Chinese girl, you can't be going now. The Chinese man married to the Thai girl who died many years ago. She was so distrustful of her husband. You know her, Lynn, but I won't mention her name. So distrustful of her husband, she asked the Buddhist Society, can we pay for her funeral? In return, that she'll leave half of her apartment in Mailand to the Buddhist Society. And I can't actually say yes or no, because I'm a monk. I asked the committee, said, well, it's obviously financially good for the Buddhist Society. So we did that. She died. We did her funeral service for her. We knew, she put her will, that half her property had to go to the Buddhist Society. But we don't go around harassing the poor guy who just lost his wife. So we waited for 2 or 3 weeks and said, no, I've got the will. He said, I can't find it. So we left it at that, another couple of weeks. Have you got the will? No, it's lost. I don't know where it is. And a few days later, he appeared at Bodhinyana Monastery really early in the morning with the will, and he could not give it to me quickly enough. And I said, why? He said, because she came to see me last night. George, you know where that will is. Give it to the monks. Poor George, I'll never forget his poor face. He was terrified because he knew where the will was, but he wouldn't give it because, you know, he was a bit stingy. And the ghost of his ex-wife had to come and haunt him and say, "Give it, get the monks the will." So when there's any unfinished business like that, you hang around for a while to make sure that, you know, the Buddhist Society gets the goods. True story. Funny, but very nice. Poor old George. I felt so sorry for him when he was so... He couldn't give me that piece of paper quickly enough. So that's the fabricators. And the other one is the formless. And it's without form and made up of perception. Now, those are the nice ones for you to understand. Just the power of the mind to perceive. You can perceive without even having a body. The mind is so strong. This is like the formless realms in jhanas. Just perception, but no stuff at all. The ability to have existence without, you know, that first kind of form stuff, but just a mind without even having to create a body. Totally independent, formless. The three types of self.
Is that the same as
no, that's just something which can happen even in the mind-made self. That's why the mind-made self, you know, which is very mostly commonly known with the ghosts. So many times this has happened, people have told me, their mother has died in England. This one guy, you don't mind Peter, his name was, you know, many of you know, he wouldn't mind me telling him, Peter Sale, you know, the ranger. His mother died in England. He was up here in Nollamara, in Nile Away. Woke up in the middle of the night, turned on the light, and his mum was at the end of the bed. The only time he's ever seen a ghost in his whole life, he knew it was his mum. He wasn't at all scared because his mother was smiling at him. And he just smiled back. He had his, not just for a flash, it was about 3 or 4 minutes, he said. Just smiling at each other, he knew his mother had passed away. And then after 3 or 4 minutes, it just faded. Had the lights on, no imagination at all, for a long time. Perfect peace, he felt so serene. But he knew his mother must have died. So after she faded away in the middle of the night, he was an English man, so what did English people do in such situations? Make a cup of tea. That's what he did. He got up, put the kettle on, made a cup of tea, and then, sort of while he was drinking his tea, telephone rang, sister in London, in Essex, Peter, got some bad news, your mum has died. What? How do you know? Oh, she's just come to visit me. That's just so classic that, you know, in the mind-made realm, so space has no real meaning. Time still has, but not space.
So that's going to exist in our time, in our bodies, and that's the extension. So that seconds of self-truth you're talking about, the mind itself, is an extension of a facility that we have in here and now.
In one sense, but we're going to come to that, because you can only have one acquired self at a time. Interesting. This is coming up in a moment.
Obviously, the third one doesn't have body.
Yeah. They have the other three candors, feeling. In other words, happiness or sadness, yeah. And they certainly have perception, they have will, thought, and also, obviously, consciousness. They have four candors, but not the fifth. Now, that's something else. That's actually an interesting one, because that's actually the psychic power of having many bodies. Because they will be mind-made cells. Actually, that's an interesting one. You can have many mind-made bodies at the same time. That's actually one of the psychic powers, but it's very rare. So for most of us, one at a time is more than enough. And anyway, paragraph 40. But I teach a doctrine for getting rid of the gross acquired self, whereby defiling mental states disappear and states tending to purification grow strong, and one remains in the purity and perfection of wisdom here and now, having realized and attained it by one's own super knowledge. So it is getting rid of the body, but almost like by a path of having defiling mental states. He's saying the path of overcoming that gross body. Defiling mental states. And there was one of the suttas there, the Aganya Sutta, where it says that beings, they were usually very refined until they started getting into desire and craving, and that solidified their bodies in the evolution story of the Buddha. And the more they had the defilements, the more solid their bodies became. It's almost like the mental defilements made you very, very physical. And the more that you had the purity, the less physical you were. Very interesting idea. Well, sometimes the mind-made ghosts stick around a lot. But, you know, it's almost like the more defiled you are, the heavier and more solid are your bodies. I don't mean like fatter. I mean, otherwise I'll be a big hypocrite. I mean just, you know, you really get into the body much more than anything else. But in this particular case, it was actually saying the way to let go of this body is actually to let go of some of the mental defilements. It can be a condensation of energy which actually starts to make the body really stiff and, yeah.
soul that manifests as a body. And that thinking keeps going. Then the body starts to concentrate, got condensed, and actually starts to get psychosomatic illnesses.
Yeah, okay, yeah. In the sick body, yeah. Anyway, let's get going. Where we got the? So I teach a doctrine of getting rid of the gross, fabricated self, where defining mental states disappear and states tend to purification grow strong. One gains and remains in the purity and perfection of wisdom here and now, having realized and attained it by one's own super knowledge. There's actually another little thing which is worthwhile saying there. I remember just with the idea of like levitation. You know, of the body being so light, it's almost not there. I remember the Buddha actually saying that once. He says sometimes his body, because of great purification of the mind, so pure, it feels as light as a feather. Now, I'm sure that many of you had those experiences in meditation. Your body feels just so light when you're meditating. You know, as if like there was a blast of wind, you'll just float up in the air just like a feather. And that is also there's a perception which comes in deep meditation when you've got very pure mind states, a lot of compassion and a lot of letting go, a lot of peace. You know, even the feeling of the body is not so solid anymore. But when you're really upset or craving, you really feel very solid and just really heavy. That one. Saying that you believe that in the West and the East they say there's a slight change of weight just before you die. And I remember as a student we did experiments in the Psychic Research Society of Cambridge on that, and it didn't work, but I met a lot of good friends. But it didn't work. But anyway, that's another thing altogether. Now Potapada, in the middle of paragraph 40. You may think perhaps those defiling mental states might disappear and why one might still be unhappy. This is not how it should be regarded. If defiling states disappear, nothing but happiness and delight develops. Tranquility, mindfulness and clear awareness. And that is a happy state. Brilliant. Because sometimes people say, oh, meditation is boring. Why don't you Buddhists get a life and go to see the football or go to the pub or go and have a party and enjoy yourselves? Meditation, just a bunch of wowsers. You can't drink alcohol, you can't go to parties. And the thing, it's not happy. And the Buddha says, that is not how it should be regarded. If defining states disappear, nothing but happiness and delight develops. And afterwards, tranquility. When you're happy, you become very still. And mindfulness and clear awareness come. That is a happy state. Mindfulness and clear awareness is not something you decide to do. I'm going to be mindful. You get rid of your defiling states. You let go of greed, hatred and stuff. Once you've let go of that, then you develop this happiness and tranquility, and then you're mindful. Sometimes people put mindfulness first, the cart before the horse. Instead of letting go of the defiling states, beautiful tranquility and happiness, then you're mindful. I also teach a doctrine for getting rid of the mind-made fabricated self, and that's paragraph 41 and paragraph 42. And in each one of these, you should not understand that one might still be unhappy. As these things disappear, defiling states disappear, nothing but happiness and delight develops. Important to say, this is not a path of misery. It's a path of happiness. Paragraph 43. Potapada, if others ask us, what friend is this gross fabricated self whose abandonment you preach? Being so asked, we should reply, this is the gross acquired self for the getting rid of which we teach a doctrine. In other words, he's already pointed out what this gross fabricated self is, this body made up of the four elements. What is the mind-made acquired self, the formless acquired self? You already pointed it out, you know, the one which exists after death. So, having said that, what do you think, Potapada? Does not this statement turn out to be at least well-founded? If you don't understand it, at least you can make sense. Certainly, Lord. And then he goes on to give the statements again. It is just as if a man were to build a staircase for a palace, which was actually below that palace. The palace was already there, so you know where to build a staircase. They might say to him, well now, this staircase for a palace you are building, do you know whether the palace will be faced east, west, or north, or south? Will it be high, low, or medium high? And you say, look, this staircase is right under the palace. Don't you think that man's statement will be well-founded? Certainly, Lord. In other words, you make it so it's very clear and not airy-fairy, not leaning on some idea which doesn't exist yet. In just the same way, Potipata, if others ask us, what is this gross acquired self? What is this mind made acquired or fabricated self? What is this formless fabricated self? We say, this is the gross mind made formless self. Yes, you can point to it, just like you can point to a palace. Point to a palace which has already been built. This is the gross, the mind-made, the formless, fabricated self, for the getting rid of which we teach a doctrine whereby defiling mental states disappear and states tending to purification grow strong, and one gains and remains in the purity and perfection of wisdom here and now, having realized and attained it by one's own super knowledge. Don't you think this statement is well-founded? At this, Chitta, the son of the elephant trainer, said to the Lord, Lord, whenever the gross fabricated self is present, would it be wrong to assume the existence of the mind-made fabricated self or the formless fabricated self? Does only the gross fabricated self truly exist then? And similarly with the mind-made fabricated self and the formless fabricated self? Chitta, when the gross fabricated self is present, we do not at that time speak of a mind-made fabricated self. We do not speak of a formless fabricated self. We speak only of a gross fabricated self. Whenever the mind-made fabricated self is present, we speak only of that, not of the others. Chitta, suppose I were to ask you, did you exist in the past or didn't you? Will you exist in the future or won't you? Do you exist now or don't you? How would you answer? Lord, if I were asked such a question, I would say, I did exist in the past, I did not exist. I shall exist in the future, and I shall not exist. I do exist now, I do not exist. That, Lord, would be my answer. But, Chitta, if they asked, the past fabricated self that you had, is that your only true fabricated self, and are the future and present ones false? Or is the one you will have in the future the only true one, and are the past and present ones false? Or is your present acquired self the only one true? The only true one and the past one's false, how would you reply? Lord, if they asked me these things, I would reply, my past fabricated self was at that time my only true one. The future and present ones were false. My future acquired self will then, in the future, be the only true one. The past and present ones will be false. My present fabricated self is now the only true one. The past and future ones are false. That is how I would reply. In other words, you only got one self at a time, the fabricated self. And it's thinking about the past and the future. You know, in the future, what is there in the future, that will be real, and what's now in the past is gone. These fabricated selves, they're all unique. It's not the same you today as it was yesterday, and it won't be the same as in the future. At least Chitta had that one down correct. In just the same way, Chitta, whenever the gross fabricated self is present, we do not at that time speak of the other ones. And this is actually a simile they have often in India because they were really into milk products. So, in justice, I'm going to change this a little bit. In just the same way, Chitta, from the cow we get milk. From the milk we get condensed milk. From condensed milk, we get cups of tea for Ajahn Brahm. And when there is milk, we don't speak of condensed milk or tea. And when there is condensed milk, we don't speak of milk or Ajahn Brahm's tea. Whenever we speak of Ajahn Brahm's tea, we don't speak of condensed milk or milk. Just one comes from the other. So too, whenever the gross fabricated self is present, we do not speak of the other ones. But, Chitta, these are merely names, expressions, terms of speech, designations in common use in the world which the Tathagata uses without misapprehending them. In other words, these are just, you don't call them a self as something which is always going to be existing. This is just the three types of possible, you know, expressions of being. A gross one, which is, you know, the body you can see right now, the mind-made one, or the formless one. Three different types of self. Not to be thought of as real, in the sense of always persisting through eons of time, but just as what you make just to, as a vehicle for the expression of your sensual experience. And at these words, Potapada the Wanderer said to the Lord, "Excellent Lord, excellent. It is as if someone were to set up what had been knocked down, or to point out the way to one who had got lost, or to bring an oil lamp into a dark place, so that those with eyes could see what was there. Just so the Blessed One has expounded the Dhamma in various ways. Lord, I go for refuge to the Lord, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. May the Lord accept me as a lay follower who has taken refuge in him from this day forth as long as life shall last." So that, you know, he was Potapada, who only just exchanged courteous greetings with him before, now becomes a disciple. But Chitta, the son of the elephant trainer, said to the Lord Buddha, he asked the deeper questions about the types of acquired or fabricated selves. "Excellent Lord, excellent. It is as if someone were to set up what had been knocked down, or to point out the way to one who got lost, or to bring an oil lamp into a dark place so that those with eyes could see what was there." This is just standard. "Just so the Blessed One has expounded the Dhamma in various ways. Lord, I go for refuge to the Lord, the Dhamma, and the Sangha." And he also said, "May I, Lord, receive the going forth of the Lord's hand, may I receive ordination." And actually, those are the two types of ordination. The going forth is the novice ordination, and the other one is the full ordination. Even at that time, there were those two forms of ordination. First of all, as a novice, and then the full ordination as a monk or a bhikkhuni. And Chitta, son of the elephant trainer, received the going forth of the Lord's hands and later the ordination. And the newly ordained, venerable Chitta, alone, secluded, unwearying, zealous, and resolute, in a short time attained to that for the sake of which young men and young women, and some old men and old women, Venerable, go forth, from good birth, go forth from the household life into homelessness. That unexcelled culmination of the holy life, having realized it here and now, by his own super knowledge, and dwelt therein. This is Chitta, knowing birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is nothing further here. And the venerable Chitta, son of the elephant trainer, became another one of the arahats. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So that is Potapada Sutta. It's a very deep sutta. That's why some of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya, this is the long discourses, are so long that you usually can't teach them unless you go over two sessions. And it's very rare for me to have two sessions in a row where I can actually teach this. I'm usually overseas somewhere. But for some reason, and I promise I won't let this happen again, I forgot to make any appointments overseas in November. So you got me for two consecutive times. So very good. So now we have questions from overseas. See what we've got overseas. And then we have any questions from here. Very good. Ah, from New York and from Singapore. So this is, was it Rupert Murdoch from New York? No, it's not Rupert Murdoch. It's John. "As you have said, there seems to be a lot of similarities between near-death experiences and jhana, yet it seems near-death experiencers don't have to overcome the five hindrances. It seems in near-death experiences, the consciousness, having been detached from the five senses, is able to access enhanced perceptions and memories which are unavailable to normal day-to-day consciousness. Is it possible that the first four jhanas prepares a person to reach that stage, or are the immaterial attainments also needed? Is it possible to have a physical death if one stays in jhanas for too long?" There are quite a few questions there. It's first of all, when the five hindrances are overcome, for many of them, they are very much connected to a body. You know, like, even like sloth and torpor. That's a very much a bodily induced thing. Yeah, sometimes you can be a bit dull in the mind, but a lot of it is a physical stuff. And I remember telling that story. I've been telling the monks that, you know, I like air cons. Actually, they're not turned on this afternoon. It's not that hot. Because I would always suffer from sleepiness at 3 o'clock in the morning in Thailand. You know, didn't have much sleep. But then when I went to Bangkok to do my visa, we stayed in this monastery, Wat Bol Won, which was that Sangharaja's monastery. There was a place there, a new building we could actually stay overnight while we were doing our visas. And we found they had a meeting hall which had an air conditioner. The first time I ever seen an air conditioner in any monastery, because this was the Big Shot monastery sponsored by the king. And so we managed to get the key. And so at 3 o'clock in the morning, we'd get up, we'd meditate in an air-conditioned room in Bangkok. And all my sloth and torpor vanished. I was just so great meditation. And I realized the sloth and torpor was a physically induced thing because the climate was just so oppressive. And I had wonderful meditation there just because of the air con. And so you realize that sometimes the five hindrances are actually bodily induced. So when you actually die and the body disappears, the five hindrances are much easier to overcome. Sensory desire, you know, you got your body's gone, mate. You can't have any sex now. Or, you know, you're not really feeling hungry anymore. You haven't got a tummy anymore to feel hungry. And many of your sort of sensory desires, you know, are just either ameliorated or knocked out at death, which is one of the other reasons why in traditional Buddhism, after you die, that's a great time to get enlightened. If you haven't got enlightened in this life, after that death experience, first of all, you've had to let go of the body. You have a good idea what this body is once it's vanished. And number two, your five hindrances are really weakened by that absence of your body. So you really got a great chance. That's why a lot of times in the suttas, they say people, you know, they didn't get enlightened before, but after death, they really got it. So there is that sort of help with having those near-death experiences. Enhanced perceptions and memories, that's just, you know, as many people know with hypnosis, you're accessing the mind rather than accessing the brain. So, you know, as many times people could, they can remember things under hypnosis they cannot remember with their brain. It's just another way of memorizing, another way of knowing. Still remember one of those examples. There was a lady who was under hypnosis. It was one of those reincarnation experiment films. And just the hypnotist, she was in a trance under hypnosis, and she said she was had a previous life in Germany just around the Second World War time. And so, because she was relaxing, she had her glasses off on the bed and being hypnotized. And the cheeky hypnotist gave her a map of, I think, of was Berlin or whatever town it was at the time, and said, "Where did you live?" And she looked at the map and said, "Oh, just that's where my house was." And after taking her out of hypnosis, he gave her the map again and said, "Where was your house?" And, "Oh, I can't see anything. Give me my glasses." He said, "But, you know, you could see without your glasses under hypnosis." And that's a common thing. How on earth can you see without glasses under hypnosis? But you need your glasses just in normal consciousness. Because, you know, not being able to see clear, that's a physical thing. So it's obviously you're accessing another part. Now, mind-made body with all its senses, the mind is seeing that map. So that's what happens under hypnosis, which is similar to what happens under NDEs. You're actually accessing the mind rather than the body. And lastly, is it possible the first four jhanas prepares the person to reach that stage, or are the immaterial attainments needed? For any old jhana, I shouldn't really say any old jhana, they're great states. Any jhana just will power your mind, and when you come out afterwards, you know, your five hindrances are gone for a long time. So yes, after you've had a jhana, the five hindrances disappeared for a while, you can do all sorts of amazing things. So it doesn't need to have, you know, the immaterial jhanas. And last question, is it possible to have a physical death if one stays in jhana for too long? It really depends how long, but there's so many stories about people in jhanas who just would not die when they should have. The story in the suttas Sinasangyutta somewhere. I told it so often, but here it comes again. This monk was, in the time of the Buddha, meditating in the jungle. He was obviously in the jhana because when two villagers passed by, they thought he was dead. And these villagers were devout Buddhists, so they thought it's not right to leave a monk dead in the jungle to get eaten by animals. So they were in the forest. It's easy to get some dead wood and make a funeral pyre, which is what they did. And they put the monk on top. They lit the fire, and when the fire was established and the monk was obviously going to burn, they were busy people. They went off to do their work, thinking the fire would do the rest. And the following morning, they were very impressed when the monk came in their village for alms, not even a charred spot on his robe. If you're in jhana, you just cannot be burnt. So don't worry if you happen to get into jhana and your dear wife thinks you're dead and puts you in the box and they take you to Karakata and put you in the ovens. Don't worry. When they open up the door of the ovens, you'll still be there saying, "Hi, me again." You're unable to be cremated. Now, don't ask me why. That's what it says in the sutras. But I have my own personal story of this. There was an Indonesian monk I met many years ago, and you know, he was one guy who did have great powers. One of my friends, you know, I don't know if you ever saw that. There was a documentary, The Princess, the Monk and the Forest. It's Nuni, her name was. She was a granddaughter of one of the kings of Thailand. But she was, you know, pretty idiosyncratic lady. But she went to a meditation class, again in this Wat Bawang, with this monk. I don't know what's happened to him now. His name was Sudamo, an Indonesian monk. He disappeared. I'm not sure what happened to him. And she said it was in a meditation class, like I sat the afternoon, and she felt that something weird was happening. And she opened her eyes and she said rays of light were coming out of this monk's eyes at different people, just like in the movies. But they said this was real. This was a good friend. She would not lie. That was absolutely real. And that monk really had some strong powers. And he told me personally how he got those powers. He was a lay person. And in Java, when the time when there was still lots and lots of jungles in Java, and there's a whole tradition in Java of hermits, rishis, going into the jungle and spending days, months, years there meditating. And that's what he did. He went into the jungle, he meditated, and I remember him telling, he said he was meditating and a star came to him. And he said it was like a David, and he married that star. That was how he put it. Star was nimitta, and marrying would just unite into it. And he said he was, didn't know how long he was there, but for a long time. He said when he came out of that state, you know, he knew the place where he'd sat had changed. There was a lot of destruction around. And he asked the local villagers what had happened. There had been a flood for many days. And where he sat was under 2 or 3 meters of water. And he should be sitting there, number one, he didn't realize he'd been submerged for such a long time. And it didn't really matter. He was in a deep meditation for about 2 or 3, 4 days. Totally okay. So if there are any floods, if you get caught in a bushfire at Dhammasana, if there is a meteor heading to Perth right now, get into jhana quick and you will survive. Fascinating. But actually, that to me, actually, that makes sense. Weird, but it makes sense. There's too much evidence. If you stay too long in jhana, I think if you stay too long in jhana, that's another ball game altogether. Sometimes you're so still for too long, there's nothing to sustain the body. And just basically you get reborn in the jhana realms. You just don't come back. But I mean, that's days and days. And anyway, question 2 from Singapore. I have a friend whose dad died on the day and he had a dream of his dad that night. Does that mean his dad visited him in his dream before he died or after? Just like you mentioned about how the ranger and his mum visited him at his bed. Okay, I think what you're saying, his dad died first, you dreamt of his dad afterwards. So that's, you know, obviously a visit. But you know, sometimes when people are very sick and dying, they sort of kind of leave their body and then go back again, they leave the body, go back again. So if it was before he died, that could also be happening. His dad just leaving the body, just he's on the edge of life and death. His basically his body is so weak, it's very easy for the mind to leave. So that could also happen. You get a visit from your loved one before they die. You know, if they're really, really, really sick. If it's someone who dies in a car accident, obviously that would never happen. But someone who's having this long, lingering death, getting weaker and weaker and weaker, on the edge of life and death, coming and going, you know, that can happen. They can come and see you before they die. But mostly afterwards. But that has not too much to do with the Potapada Sutta, but nevertheless, interesting questions. Before we finish, any questions from not overseas, but inside these seas? Yes.
The formless acquired self, if you're in meditation, in deep meditation, no body, no time, sitting there for many hours, but there's an awareness of pleasant or unpleasant experience and some of those things that you mentioned. Is that you, a person experiencing their formless acquired self? In other words, no body, no time.
Yeah, it is. Again, they have the formless attainments in deep meditation. Really, that it should be based on the fourth jhana, absolute equanimity. Because sometimes if you just rush through those attainments, those deep states of stillness, the mind sort of disappearing stage by stage, if you rush through, then it's so easy to basically, again, using that word, fabricate sort of an immaterial attainment. And just basically, you want to have it so much, you create it. And it's not the real thing. That is why, as a meditation teacher, if you tell me you have one of those experiences, I say, what happened before? Where did you come from? And if you did actually go through the jhanas one after the other, and you went through them, and then you get to that stage, okay, fair enough. Now I can actually sort of say that's almost certain. But if you didn't go through the jhanas first of all, maybe not.
And jhanas are sequential?
You know, sorry?
Jhanas are sequential. You never jump from one to four or three to
you
seven.
You go through very quickly, but they are sequential.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. If after death, yes.
Yes, and it's so free and easy and the hindrances are weakened. Why would you want to take up another body for? Why would you want to be reborn?
A lot of time that's all people know. It's like if a person gets released from prison, why do they go back again? You know, it's because they feel comfortable. That's where they know. That's where they feel they belong. So that idea of a prisoner being in a prison for such a long time, when they get released, they just can't stand that, even though it should be much more freedom. They want to go back to where they think they belong.
So is it a good idea to stay just in the mind-body?
No, the best thing is actually when you're in the body to get understanding, when you're in the prison, to actually to go and have people visit you, talk to you, actually to look after you when you first leave prison, maybe to do work release, maybe go and work at Bodhinyana Monastery, as many prisoners do, and get used to being outside. So what we mean there is like work release, you know, from prison, is when you're meditating, getting out of this body in jhanas. That's like work release. You're only out for a few hours, but it gives you a taste of what it's like to be out of this body. So when you do die, you're quite, oh, here we go. This is beautiful. You don't get afraid. And you're quite used to something different. The attachment is not something we decide to do. Sometimes the attachment is automatic. We always go back to where, you know, our old happy hunting grounds. The places where we've been before. We incline back towards that because we feel comfortable there. Very few people are adventurous and brave enough to go to somewhere new. The old pile of shit simile and the worm. This is my pile of shit. It's my food. It's fragrant. It's warm. I don't want to go to heaven.
Also, what I meant also too is that if you realise that and you don't want to be reborn, say into human again, so is staying in the mind body, is that advantage or not?
That is an advantage, yes, because you actually know something new. It's okay just not wanting to get reborn again, but where the heck are you going to go? So, you know, if you've got nowhere else to go, you have to stay here. So at least gives you more opportunities, more options after death, more experiences, so you can understand what is available for you once death happens. Other people, they haven't got a clue what happens after death. They've got no options except to come back again. They come back to the only place they know. Okay, we might finish now because here comes Kenny. So, hi Kenny. So it's 4:28. Very good, Kenny. Your very simple, gross, acquired self and your mind-made self. His name is Kemachara. Okay, so we'll do a bit of chanting now to finish off the class. We're doing some chanting now. And I'll do a bit of bowing as well. The Arahang Sama. Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddha Bhagavantang Abhiwa Devi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipano Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sangam Namah.